This time on your weekly Constitutional, the Second Amendment after Las Vegas. We'll hear from two experts. First, Saul Cornell of Fordham University.
You know, I don't know anyone who's not a gun rights ideologue and who's a gun owner who believes that allowing people to carry guns without any range time makes a whole lot of sense.
And then we'll hear from an unexpected source that perhaps gun control can never work. His name is James Jacobs of NYU.
How have we done with prohibiting drugs? All we had to do was pass some laws, and did we see then that we solved the problem? No.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this time it's about the Second Amendment after Las Vegas.
Don't change that station. It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
The recent tragedy in Las Vegas has prompted a return to the seemingly never-ending debate over gun control and the Second Amendment. Has anything fundamentally changed? We're used to saying that nothing does change after one of these shootings, but now, for the first time, at least in my memory, the National Rifle Association is actually coming out in favor of some kind of regulation on a new device that I'd never heard of before Las Vegas, something called a bump stock, a device that allows a semi-automatic rifle, one where you have to pull the trigger once for each shot, to function more like a fully automatic rifle or a machine gun, where you can simply hold the trigger down once and shots will come out of the barrel repeatedly. That, of course, is what the shooter used in Las Vegas, and that is what the NRA is saying it favors some regulation of. That is a new development. How significant it is, we don't know yet. But I thought it was a good time to return to the Second Amendment roots of this entire debate and invite a couple of experts on the show. The first of them is Saul Cornell. He's from Fordham University, and he's going to give us an overview of the entire early history of the Second Amendment, because that's his specialty, early constitutional history. Later on, we will hear from James Jacobs of NYU, who may surprise you with some of his research and conclusions about whether gun control can work. But first, let's hear from Saul.
My name's Saul Cornell. I'm a professor of history, and I teach law at Fordham University in New York, and I study early American constitutional history and have been working on the Second Amendment and the history of gun regulation for the better part of the last 15 to 20 years.
Very timely topic for a historian. It seems that your interest in this predates the seminal decision back in 2008 of Heller. Looks like you picked a good area.
Yes, I actually, people always want to know how you got into this topic and whether you had some strong policy interest or ideological preference on the issue. And actually, I backed into this issue because I was interested in the Anti-Federalists, the original opponents of the Constitution. And what I noticed is that there was a whole new body of legal scholarship that seemed to be blossoming in law reviews about the Second Amendment, and it mentioned the Anti-Federalists. And having studied them for the last 10 years of my life prior to that, I really couldn't recognize the people who were being summoned to testify, resurrected from obscurity to tell us what the Second Amendment meant. So I really just got into the debate to sort of correct some of the historical errors I perceived, and then it sort of took on a life of its own.
Oh, the horror. You mean that lawyers and judges have been misusing history in their legal analysis?
I know. It's shocking. It's a good thing I'm sitting down and you're sitting down. Otherwise, you know, we'd have to pass the smelling salts, wouldn't we?
Well, since you are a historian, why don't we start at the very beginning? And could you just give us a brief overview of the genesis of the Second Amendment?
Well, sure. I mean, I find that the Second Amendment is probably one of the most often invoked but least well understood features of our constitutional tradition. And there are reasons why it has emerged as such a misunderstood part, because for so many people, the Second Amendment speaks directly to the issues of gun control and gun rights. The historical Second Amendment, however, is a very different creature indeed. It emerges out of the Whig political tradition, the civic Republican tradition. It emerges in a largely rural society. It emerges at a time in American history where the fear of standing armies is pervasive, where the understanding of citizenship is very different, where security and allegiance are seen as reciprocal, where rights often carry responsibilities and duties. If you think about it for a moment, in the first state constitutions, first of all, most of the first state constitutions didn't even have an arms-bearing provision, and often when they did, they actually had a right not to bear arms. Now, if you stop and ponder that for a moment, what on earth could a right not to bear arms mean?
Yeah. Please, well, don't tell me.
Well, sure. Of course, what it refers to the fact is that among all the rights that are carved out in these first state constitutions and eventually in our federal bill of rights, bearing arms is the one right that government can compel you to do, which is runs counter to the way we think about rights in modern America. We usually think about rights in modern America as Trump's, not as in the sense of President Trump, but more in the bridge sense, that they're a strong claim against government interference, that rights may impose obligations on others, but they don't usually impose obligations on the holder of the right. But of course, in the 18th century, coming out of both a natural law tradition and a Republican tradition, rights often were encumbered by obligations.
That is very interesting, because you're right. We tend to think of constitutional rights, especially as negative rights, as ways to stop the government from doing something. But that's a different conception you're talking about. And why would people be compelled to bear arms back in the late 18th century?
Well, we have to, think about the very different world that the founders lived in. For one thing, if we start in the colonial period, they're living on the edge of the British Empire. They're facing hostility in the form of Indians who haven't been particularly happy about expansion of European settlement. There are Spanish presence in the south, French presence in the north, in what is now Quebec. A lot of these geopolitical issues are also imbued with a religious dimension, because it's Protestant England versus Catholic France and Catholic Spain. And of course, there's no police force, right? So if you're going to maintain order, if you're going to protect yourself against slave insurrections in the south or agrarian uprisings like Shay's Rebellion in the north, a well-regulated militia is pretty much all that stands between you and anarchy.
And so this was very much directly tied to militia service. We may need a militia, we may need to call it into effect, and therefore you need to have your arms ready.
Absolutely. I mean, in a sense, the militia statutes, which are among the longest in colonial laws, they run on for pages and pages and have very detailed expectations about what you are supposed to do. I mean, you can be fined for not reporting to muster, you can be fined for not having your weapon in good working order, your weapon can be inspected. It actually makes us think more of a society like Israel or Switzerland, where you have, in effect, the cost of military service being transferred to individual households, that the public defense of either the state, the community, and eventually the nation depends on these citizen soldiers meeting their obligations.
Yeah, I've heard that over the years, references to Switzerland and to Israel having more or less universal military service, especially Israel. And in fact, I seem to recall that when there have been emergencies in Israel over the past few decades, that the first thing you hear about is people being sent home to pick up their weapons.
You know, it's really fascinating you mention that, because people in the modern policy debate often say that gun control won't work, there's no evidence for it. But one of the most striking examples of how gun regulation can save lives actually comes from the Israeli Defense Force.
Yeah.
The Israeli Defense Force, as you noted, traditionally allowed soldiers to take weapons home. Of course, with the constant deployments you face in Israel, given the geopolitical situation, they noticed that suicide rates were spiking. And one thing they decided to do was, with the exception of very specialized units of the Israeli Defense Forces, to have people not take their guns home. And they actually saw a 40% reduction in suicide rates within the IDF, which is a staggering policy effect for a pretty simple gun regulation measure.
Okay, so you've got this background. You've got very interesting militia statutes and the right not to bear arms in some circumstances in state constitutions. So then we come up to 1787 and then subsequently 1791, when there's been the introduction of the Second Amendment. Could you talk about that specifically, the Second Amendment in the National Constitution?
the idea that somehow this new federal government, which will have considerable authority over the militia, basically will be able to pass militia statutes, will be able to summon the militia, frightens supporters of states' rights, of a kind of different version of federalism, the people who oppose the Constitution, the anti-federalists. And somewhere about a couple of months into the debate over ratification in Pennsylvania, the idea of framing an amendment that will protect the right to bear arms emerges. Pennsylvania actually has a unique formulation. They talk about bearing arms both in this more militia sense and also use it in a more capacious sense, in a broader sense, to actually include hunting. Nobody else actually picks up on the Pennsylvania language, but the idea that a right to bear arms in a well-regulated militia is something that will be indispensable to protecting liberty, both liberty of individuals and liberty of the states, is essential in the debate over the Constitution. Again, you know, we tend to think of states as having powers, not rights. But of course, in the early Republic, there are many people talking about states' rights in one form or another. And so anti-federalists agitate for two things. They agitate for something that very much looks like what becomes the Second Amendment. And they also agitate for a return of authority over the militia back to the states. Now, they're not successful because James Madison outmaneuvers them in Congress, but they are successful in getting this Second Amendment. Of course, many of the anti-federalists are very disappointed because they feel like without some structural change, this Second Amendment is not going to do much good. However, it's also important, I think, to recognize that in the 18th century, we're not talking about a modern understanding of the way Bills of Rights work. We still have a pretty weak notion of judicial review. We're pre-Marbury. The idea that bills of rights provide strong claims that can be litigated in courts is not yet the norm. There isn't a lot of case law in that area. So provisions in bills of rights are often aspirational. They're often sort of tools of civic instruction. So Madison feels like, sure, we'll let you reaffirm this fundamental idea of the right to bear arms and the necessity of a well-regulated militia, and that's fine. And the anti-federalists say, well, that aspirational text is great, but without something with teeth, it's never actually going to be anything. So the anti-federalists are actually pretty disappointed with the form of the Second Amendment that Madison and the First Congress gives them.
That's really interesting. Let's unpack that just a little bit. So you say that the Pennsylvania conception was very capacious. That is, it was not merely a militia-related right to bear arms, but an individual right to bear arms to do things like hunting. And that, of course, will come back much later in the Heller decision as part of it. But more generally, is it your understanding that when the Second Amendment itself was adopted, that it was tied closely to this notion of militia and this notion that states needed some sort of independent military force, which may in fact have been deployed against a tyrannical national government?
Well, you know, we have generally in the modern era sort of seen the Second Amendment as either an individual or collective right. I don't think either of those formulations is true to the 18th century spirit of what those words meant, in part because we have a very different understanding of the way constitutions work. I think that the holders of the right in the 18th century are clearly actually not individuals, but citizens, which is, although in the modern sense, those two categories have come much closer to fusing. But in the 18th century, for instance, women or slaves or resident aliens would certainly have had a right under the English common law and later the American version of the common law to self-defense. That was well established at common law, but we wouldn't describe women as bearing arms. So the idea that the right that really is most close to the hearts of modern Americans, the right of individual self-defense, in the 18th century was largely understood to be protected at common law. There were certainly some people moving in the direction of a more modern individualistic conception. Thomas Jefferson, for instance, had a more broad understanding of what it meant. But the dominant view, I think, was still this idea that you bear arms when you participate in a well-regulated militia or other forms of public defense. And of course, you always have your right of self-defense, which is going to be determined by the individual state's criminal law, you know, whether you have to retreat. And in most cases in the 18th century, you did actually have to retreat. You didn't have a stand your ground right until the 19th century. That emerges much later in American law. So the entire constellation of ideas which embeds the Second Amendment in this 18th century conception of law is very alien to us. And that's why so many people talk about the Second Amendment, whether it's judges in Heller or legislators in Congress or even legal scholars without a good grounding in history invariably read backward these modern ideas and sort of think they're talking about the original meaning, but they're really talking about a modern version of the Second Amendment that took a while to expand and to blossom into its current robust form.
You know, you're the historian, and correct me if I'm wrong, but original meaning presupposes a single meaning, when in fact there were dozens, hundreds, thousands of people who participated in the drafting and the proposing and the ratification of the Second Amendment, and each of them had his own conception of exactly what that meant.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the biggest problems with originalism, even in its current form, and you know, we have moved away from original intent, focused on specific intents of individuals, to so-called public meaning. Mm-hmm. But I think you're quite right that if you were able to actually interview one of the rebels in Shays' Rebellion, Alexander Hamilton, and a rich Virginia planter, and you ask them, you know, what does freedom of the press mean, or what does the right to bear arms mean? It's quite possible you would have gotten subtly different understandings. So even if you use the same words, I think in a society like 18th century America, which is divided in so many different ways, the subtle understanding of the meaning of those words could be quite different.
Indeed, it could be. Just as today, different people had different opinions back then.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about the Second Amendment after the tragedy in Las Vegas. We've been speaking with Saul Cornell, who's a constitutional historian at Fordham University. And after the break, after we have our constitutional quiz, we'll speak a little bit more with Saul. Then later on, we'll be speaking with another expert. His name is James Jacobs of NYU. Stick around. And now it's time, once again, and into the Potter Studios strides a lonely figure, carrying with him the knowledge of the centuries and one question for an extremely qualified contestant. His name is Doug Smith.
Hey,
how are you, Doug?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you doing?
I'm doing extremely well today.
That was a great ramp up.
You like that?
I do.
You like that? Well, you're a very impressive guy.
I want you to record like my my alarm clock.
I could do that. And so that every morning.
Hear,
exactly.
That would be fantastic.
Your wife would love that, wouldn't it? Hearing my voice every morning. I think I would get in a lot in trouble there.
Yes, okay. More than you know, because if I just started saying to her, I can't wait to hear Stuart in the morning.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, it goes downhill from
it
there.
It goes downhill, exactly right. We have a contestant, and who are you?
Mary Hillebrenner.
Mary Hillebrenner. Where are you from, Mary Hillebrenner?
Easton, Pennsylvania.
Easton, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Easton, like Eston.
Mm-hmm.
Not Eastern.
No, Easton.
Easton. And where is Easton?
Easton is the most eastern, I would say, city in Pennsylvania, bordering the New Jersey border. So
it is Eastern Pennsylvania,
even though
it's also Easton, Pennsylvania.
Yes, it's the place actually where the Declaration of Independence was read whilst it was being read in Philadelphia and in Trenton.
Very, very impressive. Well, Doug, you have a question for Mary.
I have lots of questions, but I think I better start with this one. So, Mary, I'm going to give you a question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
Okay, I hope so.
All right, here we go. Where is judicial power of the United States vested? Where is judicial power of the United States vested? Is it invested in A, the Supreme Court and the courts it establishes, B, the Supreme Court and the inferior courts that the president establishes, C, the Supreme Court and the inferior courts that the Congress establishes, or D, a constitutional court assembled only in times of constitutional crisis? So that's a tough one. I'm going to read those again for you.
Where is the judicial power?
Where is the judicial power of the United States vested? Is it A, the Supreme Court and the courts that it, the Supreme Court, establishes? B, the Supreme Court and the inferior courts that the president establishes? C, the Supreme Court and the inferior courts that the Congress establishes? Or D, the constitutional court assembled only in times of constitutional crisis? So this question is really, Stuart, about the genesis of the courts and their power.
Yeah, and who creates them. Mary, what are you feeling here?
I'm feeling B.
You're feeling B, which is the Supreme Court and the inferior courts that the president establishes. Does the president have the power to establish courts?
Not the inferior courts. That's why I'm confused.
That's all right. Who would
do? That's a tough one.
Now, I'll help you out a little bit because we know that the only court that's specifically mentioned in the Constitution is the Supreme Court itself.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we know there that that has to exist. And we also know that there are inferior courts. So I think this question boils down to who creates those inferior courts.
So does the Supreme Court
itself
create the inferior courts? Is it the presidency that creates the inferior courts? Is it the Congress, or is it the Constitutional Court that really only gets called in times of crisis?
Do we have a constitutional court that only gets called in times of crisis?
One could say no.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I would say no.
But the Germans would love for us to have one.
Okay.
That's what the German model, of course, that South Africa has adopted, is that they have a constitutional court. And now those independent courts and commissions are really quite powerful mm-hmm. and popular in emerging situations. But I wouldn't call the United States an emerging democracy.
Mm. Well, based on discussion, I would have to say the inferior courts established by the Congress.
Okay, so which answer choice is that?
I don't know.
That's C, and you are correct.
Oh, she got it. Okay. Well done, Mary. Now, that's actually a really interesting aspect of Article 3, is it begins, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and then it goes on to say, and such inferior courts as from time to time Congress may establish. And I'm paraphrasing there. I don't have a constitution right in front of me. And I always mention to my students that we don't have to have a federal court system. In fact, since there's not a specified number of justices on the Supreme Court, in fact, they're not even referred to them that way. They're spoken of as judges. They only mention the Chief Justice. Theoretically, the entire federal judiciary could simply consist of the Chief Justice of the United States, and he would be the entire Supreme Court, and there would mm-hmm. be no other courts. It wouldn't do much good because the Supreme Court primarily has appellate jurisdiction, so you kind of need lower courts to decide cases that can then be appealed to the Supreme Court. Even though some cases do come up from the state court system, the Supreme Court wouldn't have much to do unless there were federal courts. And from right at the very beginning, the very first Congress from the Judiciary Act of 1789 created a federal court system and then gradually expanded that court system to the three-tiered system we know today. But that's just a matter of statute. Tomorrow, the Congress could abolish the entire federal court system if it wanted to. Isn't that interesting?
Very.
I find it interesting. Well, thank you very much for playing, and thank you, Doug.
Absolutely. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're asking whether anything has really changed with the Second Amendment or the gun control, gun rights debate after the tragedy in Las Vegas. Before the break, we were speaking with Saul Cornell. He's a legal historian, a constitutional historian from Fordham University. And of course, Saul and I started at the beginning.
All right, so that brings us to 1791. The Second Amendment, along with the First 10 Amendments, gets ratified.
It didn't get ratified. Let's not forget those two. Well, there are actually 12 amendments.
Oh, yes.
10 of them actually get ratified.
Yes, thank you for correcting me. We've actually discussed that fact before, and so the Second Amendment was, in fact, the Fourth Amendment when it was originally proposed. But the ones we now understand.
It cuts into the argument that it's the second most important to the founders, because it really was the fourth.
Exactly. Yeah, that's an interesting point. At any rate, what we now see as the Second Amendment was ratified in 1791. And then, to my limited historical understanding, there really wasn't much activity regarding that for the next century or so, or did much happen with it.
That's true. I mean, in Houston v. Moore, there's an oblique reference by Justice Story, who actually misnumbers it. He might actually use number four, I think. For the Second Amendment. And of course, like most provisions of the Bill of Rights, until Reconstruction, until the emergence of the Doctrine of Incorporation, none of the Bill of Rights is understood to apply against the states. They are only restrictions on the federal government, although there are a few odd state judges who are not buying into Justice John Marshall's idea in Barron v. Baltimore that the Bill of Rights is not a restraint on the states, just the federal government. But by and large, right, it means that all the action is at the state level in terms of state regulation and in terms of the first jurisprudence on the right to bear arms, which, of course, is a state jurisprudence, not a federal one.
Right. And so not much happening. In fact, the first significant reference to the Second Amendment that I'm aware of is in 1939, the Miller case.
Yes. I mean, we do have a couple of cases from the end of the 19th century, Cruikshank and Presser in particular, which deal with the relationship between the 14th Amendment and the Second Amendment. But yes, I mean, the first on-point case, as you lawyers like to say, would be Miller.
Could you tell us about that, please?
Well, Miller is this interesting case that comes up during the New Deal era. It's a response to the first efforts at federal gun regulation. You've coming off the Roaring Twenties and gangsterism, and so there's an effort to outlaw machine guns and sawed-off shotguns. And Jack Miller, I believe his first name is, violates this new law. He doesn't actually appear at his trial. It's an ex parte decision. And Justice McReynolds holds that the Second Amendment has kind of two-pronged test to determine if Jack Miller's activity was protected by the Second Amendment. You would both ask, what was the nature of the weapon he had? Was it the kind consistent with a well-regulated militia? In this case, a sawed-off shotgun was not a typical instrument of war. I mean, there may have been some sawed-off shotguns stored somewhere and used occasionally in trench cleaning, but by and large, it was not a standard issue of the United States military. And secondly, was the weapon actually used within a context that was consistent? You know, for instance, if Jack Miller had his Colt sidearm and he was a National Guardsman or even perhaps a regular army and he had taken it out to do some target shooting and ran afoul of the law, you know, that case might have come out very differently. But he was neither in possession of a weapon consistent with what the militia at that point in American history redefined as the National Guard, nor was he using it in militia activity. He was actually using it in criminal activity. So Miller was generally understood at the time to define pretty clearly the Second Amendment was intimately connected with the militia. It was often characterized as a collective rights decision, although, again, I think that's not a particularly good way of describing it.
When I was in law school, and this is back in the 1980s, that was considered the latest and greatest statement. And so basically, we all understood it, as you say, shorthand was the Second Amendment protects a collective right to bear arms as part of your service in a militia, and therefore is not particularly relevant to the entire gun control debate because it doesn't protect an individual right to keep and bear arms. Now, that was just our shorthand understanding of it. So the Second Amendment was, as of the late 20th century, sort of dead letter to everybody but this growing group of gun rights activists, notably the National Rifle Association, who were trying to make it something more. And then they did so in the Heller decision in 2008. So could you describe that, please?
Sure. Well, we have a couple of things going on. After the 1960s, you have the second great round of modern-style gun control regulation. Mm-hmm. You also have the radicalization of the NRA, which had traditionally been a kind of hunting and marksmanship organization. It becomes a kind of ideological-driven gun rights group.
Right.
That was in the 1970s. And so you also have a lot of money pouring into research by gun rights activists who are starting to publish in legal journals. You know, legal journals, you know, the last count, I think there were four legal journals for every legal scholar in America.
There are a lot of them.
Yep. I mean, there are over 1,000. Mm-hmm. And eventually, of course, after a few very diligent gun rights-oriented activists who were publishing in these law reviews published dozens of articles defending this new individual rights view, you had a couple of sort of contrarian liberals like Sanford Levinson at Texas, Nikhil Amar at Yale, go over to this theory. You know, it was interesting. It was different. It was counterintuitive, which, of course, in the law school world is a great way to make your name. I mean, a liberal saying, you know, the Second Amendment doesn't protect guns is not really headlining news. But a liberal saying, you know, the NRA may have it right is, in fact, a good way to advance your career in terms of garnering interest in your work. And that combination of laying a scholarly groundwork, having a very powerful, very well-financed lobby connected to think tanks, and of course a popular grassroots movement that really loves guns, and increasingly in the era after Watergate and after some other changes in the American economy and society, where certain kinds of traditional roles and values, particularly around gender roles and, you know, where economic outsourcing of things left many of our sort of Rust Belt industries in very bad state. This idea that you know, at the end of the day, what defines you is your gun. It aligns with all the values: patriotism, hierarchy, traditional American independence, the frontier. This whole constellation of values, suddenly that has real resonance in a way that it really was never much of an issue before.
Very interesting. So then we have Heller in 2008, and Heller does assert an individual right to keep and bear arms, and the decision written by Justice Scalia contains all sorts of historical references, and I'm guessing that perhaps you disagree with some of them.
Well, of course, what's fascinating about Heller is almost everyone disagrees with one of the shocking things about it was that conservatives, whether it's Judge Harvey Wilkinson or Charles Freed, who was Solicitor General, I believe, under Nixon, Judge Posner, who is an odd conservative but a very brilliant one, really some of the worst tongue lashing Scalia got were not from Cass Sunstein, you know, the perennial liberal, or Reva Siegel from Yale, but from the conservatives. And about the only people who seem to support Heller in terms of its intellectual framework, you know, the question about whether the D.C. law was a good law or whether it exceeded a reasonable regulation is, of course, a separate issue. But I think there's pretty broad agreement that Heller is just a kind of fantasy. I mean, you know, one of my favorite bits of Heller, my two favorite bits of Heller are where Scalia says, we actually read the Second Amendment backwards, as if it was written in Hebrew or Arabic. You go to the second clause first, you decide what it means, and then you read the first clause. I mean, as Justice Stevens points out, that has never been the way the Supreme Court, and you can't really think of another case where they read the text backwards.
Yeah, it was extraordinary, and like you say, like most people, I was not particularly impressed with the analysis that Justice Scalia used to get where he got, and I could quibble with a lot of things that he said, but ultimately, it's the law of the land. And
it is. So, it is. And I think, you know, if in fact there were so many surprising things about Heller. One of the most interesting ones, I mean, there's great backstories about Heller. Some of them are told in Adam Winkler's book, Gunfight, which mm-hmm. is a place to go. A very good scholar on this issue. But really, one of the most remarkable things was that the Bush administration and Paul Clement, who was Solicitor General, actually filed a brief which said, yes, the Second Amendment is an individual right, but we believe the law withstands constitutional scrutiny, and at a very minimum, it should be remanded back to the courts for kind of traditional balancing kind of analysis to see whether or not parts of the law could have survived or whether the whole law was a violation. And that was kind of remarkable to have both the Bush administration and Clement oppose the gun rights position or take a sort of middle ground position, if you will. So, I mean, one certainly could have imagined a very different Heller in which they struck down the law but did it under kind of a living constitution argument, for instance, where, you know, they basically said, look, you know, just like in Lawrence v. Texas, there's this evolving tradition of liberty. If you looked at the polling data on gun rights, there's no question most Americans believe the Second Amendment protects individual rights. So, fine, you know, under a living constitution, evolving tradition of liberty argument, the law is overly broad or perhaps too draconian. But what's, of course, the one argument you really can't make in good conscience is this crazy originalist argument that they chose to make. So, again, it was sort of disappointing that the court went this route when they could have resolved the case in a much more intellectually honest way.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've been speaking with Saul Cornell of Fordham University about the Second Amendment, where it came from, how it's interpreted, and just now, the 2008 decision in Heller versus District of Columbia, which has been often criticized. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Saul, and then we'll speak with another fellow. His name is James Jacobs of NYU. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Saul Cornell, a constitutional historian from Fordham University who's been telling us about the history of the Second Amendment all the way up through the 2000s. Before the break, we were just talking about the much criticized opinion of Justice Antonin Scalia in the Heller versus District of Columbia case.
And I think that perhaps leaves the decision vulnerable to future challenge. I mean, when you build your foundation on such shaky ground, then ultimately the decision itself might be revisited, and later justices may justify even overruling it or significantly limiting it by noting all of the flaws in it. But be that as it may, that was the decision, and it was later extended and applied to protect us against state interference with gun rights in the decision of McDonald versus Chicago in 2010. So now we live in a landscape where there is an individual right, but even Heller itself noted that it's not an absolute right, which is true of all constitutional rights. All constitutional rights are interpreted according to some sort of level of scrutiny, which instructs judges on, you know, how vigorously they should enforce the right or how much flexibility they have in denying it in individual cases. The Heller decision did not establish such a level of scrutiny, and it left open the idea that reasonable gun regulation is perfectly constitutional. In fact, Justice Scalia mentioned several types of regulations that might be appropriate. So where does that leave us today, especially after tragedies like Las Vegas? Is there room for reasonable gun regulation?
Well, it left us with an intellectual mess, because if the history was terrible, the doctrinal part of the case is practically incoherent. It gave us no black letter, you know, guidelines about how to apply the decision. It actually rejected a straightforward scrutiny analysis. Justice Roberts was saying, you know, we just sort of made up the whole scrutiny model for modern jurisprudence, which may well be true, but it of course is central to the way many rights are evaluated. On the one hand, you know, Heller rewrote the history, but it also told us that history is a key ingredient in analyzing whether a law is presumptively lawful. So since Heller, there have been over 1,000 challenges. Most of the gun laws have prevailed. Many of these challenges are sort of desperate attempts by criminal defense attorneys to make a Second Amendment claim, which they're almost obligated now to make if one of their clients is carrying a firearm. Mm-hmm. So we've had a lot of cases. Most of them have vindicated the laws. But it's important to realize that both Chicago and Washington laws were outliers. I mean, most laws in America are quite weak on gun regulation. The handgun bans were very, very rare. Only a couple of other jurisdictions had them. There's a whole theory of the law that says that one of the functions of the courts is to kind of strip out outliers and sort of bring a kind of relative uniformity to the law by eliminating those kinds of anomalies. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that most things are upheld, because we have fairly modest laws. Anything that can survive the political process in America is going to be pretty weak compared to the kind of gun regulations that exist elsewhere in the world. So it's not at all surprising. I mean, some people say that, you know, the lower courts are disregarding Heller. I don't think that's accurate. In fact, we have a forthcoming analysis of that in the Duke Law Journal by Joseph Blocher and Eric Rubin of Duke and NYU, respectively, which shows statistically that's not the case. So, of course, there's plenty of room for regulation. The real challenge is not constitutional, it's political. What are Americans willing to actually enact? And at least since Sandy Hook, what we've seen is, first of all, nothing at the federal level. But, of course, that's hardly unique. We can't do anything at the federal level. We haven't did any kind of effective legislation across a huge swath of issues. And, you know, Congress's popularity ratings, I think, ranked just below colonoscopies in the last, you know, polling that was done, which is really a tribute to Congress. So the question is, what's been happening at the state level? And there we have a very interesting and different story. I mean, essentially, we see something in almost a kind of geological plate tectonic shift, where red states have actually loosened their laws and blue states have tightened them. So I actually think that, you know, the great prospect I have, and I'm not usually a great optimist, I should just, you know, I like to say that I usually think the glass is half empty, cracked, and filled with poison. Full. But the one great possibility which I see looming out there is a rediscovery of the essential nature of federalism, that particularly with things like carry or assault weapons, those kinds of regulations are going to have to be state level, because the gun cultures in America are so diverse. So, you know, let's just take public carry. What makes sense in Alaska really doesn't make sense in the Bronx. And it just may be the best way to handle that is to acknowledge that difference. And, you know, people often say, but we don't do that with other individual rights. We have a uniform national standard. It's actually not true if you think about things like criminal justice. I mean, from the very beginning, trial jury provisions were always not uniform nationally. So I'm hoping, you know, I suppose it's the old anti-federalism in me reemerging itself, that we go to a kind of anti-federalist solution here, which is to say to embrace a truly federalist vision of allowing, at least in terms of some issues. I mean, the problem is that gun sales and gun markets cross state boundaries. But the worst possible outcome would be like public carry reciprocity, because, mm-hmm. you know, let's face it, you know, you need almost no range time in most states. I mean, some states have constitutional carry. You don't need anything. You know, I don't know anyone who's not a gun rights ideologue and who's a gun owner and a gun enthusiast who believes that allowing people to carry guns without any range time makes a whole lot of sense.
It's a very volatile question. And as you say, it is, differs from state to state. And as you've also pointed out, if one state feels it needs strict regulation, but it's adjacent to another one where the regulations are loose, as many people have noted is the situation in both D.C. and Chicago, well, then the strict regulation just doesn't work. Criminals cross state lines and they get their guns, you know, 10 miles away, and then they come and bring them back into the strictly controlled jurisdiction. So that does create a whole lot of problems. But on the other hand, you know, if we believe in our federal system of government, and we believe that states should be allowed to govern consistent with their individual needs, then maybe a patchwork isn't so undesirable. Unfortunately, not every state is quite as isolated as Alaska.
Yes, that's certainly true. And I do think that commerce, I mean, you know, the founders get bashed a lot these days, you know, in some cases for good reason. But the fact that that interstate commerce is a federal province and police power, you know, something like public carry or stand your ground is a state prerogative, shows at least a certain wisdom there, that there are some things that even the founders recognized had to be done at the national level for political and constitutional reasons, and some things that were best left to the state. So I think that commercial regulation, sale of firearms, really, we do need a national solution. But on certain aspects of the firearms debate, like carry or stand your ground, I think it would be just much better to leave that to the states, because we're never going to get Alabama and Massachusetts to see eye to eye on that.
I suspect that you're right.
You think?
So, yeah, I think probably so. Well, then if I may sum up your position, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Las Vegas, as terrible as it was, Sandy Hook, as terrible as it was, all the shootings, as terrible as they are, really don't change the constitutional landscape and perhaps not even the political landscape. People who believe in gun rights are going to continue to loosen restrictions. Those who believe in gun control will continue to tighten them, and Heller and McDonald, our prevailing Supreme Court opinions on this, will allow that to continue.
Yes, I mean, with one minor adjustment, you know, there's been a lot of fascinating research done in cognitive science about what people, how people process information and what is persuasive and convincing. And although this may sound shocking, I'm sure it'll shock you, it shocked me, people tend to look for ways to confirm their biases.
And that is shocking. That's just shocking, Saul, yes.
Yeah, it is shocking. And now we know neurologically that that's the case. We can actually prove that, showing which parts of our brains function and how they function. So the fact that a Las Vegas and a Sandy Hook actually underscores and confirms what people sort of believe going into it seems to be confirmed by what we know about how people behave. So, but it does intensify what they believe, actually. And that is something we need to figure out, how to deal with this issue where there are such intense beliefs, how we can have a calm, deliberate discussion in an area where people immediately gravitate to the polls and where it seems sometimes hard to have that kind of rational, deliberative discussion.
Rational, deliberative discussion. Saul, I think you've come up with a good idea. But I think we'll have to leave it there. This has been fascinating, but I think we're just about out of time. So, Saul Cornell of Fordham University, thank you so much for adding your perspective and your historical knowledge to this ongoing debate.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now let's turn to another voice, a fellow who's somewhat of a contrarian in the gun control debate, or at least he's unusual. He is an academic. He is a professor at New York University. But going back to a book he wrote over 10 years ago, he's concluded, after years of research, that perhaps gun control is a fool's errand. His name is James Jacobs. By his own admission, he's not a big fan of guns, nor does he own one. In fact, he hasn't shot one since he served in the Army some years ago. So he's not the typical person you will hear questioning the efficacy of gun control. No, for him, it's all about his own research.
We have over 300 million firearms in private hands in the United States. Every time there's any kind of move to restrict firearms further, the biggest impact that we have then is a surge in sales of guns, so we have even more.
Right.
We have about 30-35% of American households that have firearms. We have the Supreme Court having recognized a constitutional right of citizens to keep and bear arms. We have a solid political majority in favor of gun owners' rights. So I just don't see any possibility of any kind of significant legislative initiative that would make any difference.
Yeah, that number is actually really shocking to people who have not studied this. I mean, there are literally as many or more guns in this country than there are people. And as you point out in your book, these are durable items. I mean, quite literally, I know I've seen muskets from the 18th century that are still being fired today.
Exactly. And so guns can last 100 years. They don't have to be replenished. I always like to talk to my colleagues about how have we done with prohibiting drugs. All we had to do was pass some laws, and did we see then that we solved the problem? No. And we passed every imaginable kind of drug control that you can think of, and we backed it up with billions of dollars of enforcement and putting millions of people into jail and prison. And what impact has it had?
I think, as some of my Southern friends would say, it sounds like the horse done left the barn.
That's my feeling is that train has already left the station. So I'm skeptical. I'm not myself ideologically opposed to better restrictions of guns, keeping guns out of the hands of criminals. We should do that. But yeah. Is it possible at this stage in our history? That's the basis of my skepticism.
Well, is there anything out there that you've studied over the years, any form of gun control, gun regulation, that at least improves things somewhat, even if it doesn't completely achieve the goal of keeping guns out of the wrong hands?
Well, where we have the most consensus is punishing people who commit crimes with guns. I mean, there we have a solid political consensus. I mean, there's nobody really, or I should say up until recently, there's nobody who dissents from the idea that people who perpetrate crimes and commit harms with guns should face very stiff penalties. Of course, now there's a general move in the country against mass incarceration, against punishment, which may come to erode some of that consensus as well.
Well, what about some of the current proposals that have especially occurred since the recent shooting in Las Vegas, proposals to do things like limit the types of firearms or limit the so-called bump stock modifications, which make a semi-automatic more like an automatic weapon, or the limiting the size of magazines? Do you think any of those would help at least with the issue of mass shootings?
Well, I think the bump stock should definitely be prohibited or regulated in the same way that machine guns are regulated, so that in 1938, Congress placed some very significant regulations on machine guns. They could still be possessed, but you had to have a federal license. And for reasons that I don't fully understand, that worked pretty well. We still have quite a few machine guns licensees. Mostly they're target ranges and military academies and so on. And then in 1986, Congress passed a law saying there could be no more manufacture of machine guns. Machine guns have not been a problem in the U.S. We haven't, as far as I know, none of the mass shootings have been perpetrated with machine guns. Okay, and then comes along this bump stock. I didn't know about it until the Las Vegas shooting. It apparently fixes onto a semi-automatic and allows it to be fired pretty much like an automatic. That seems to me like it should be treated exactly the same way as an automatic. It seems like there's a political agreement that even the NRA wants is willing to accept treating bump stocks the same way as automatics. So I think that's a good idea. I would go further. I would think they should be prohibited. But we want to make a distinction between prohibiting something and actually ending its availability. I mean, we have prohibited a lot of things, and they're still available. So once these bump stocks, you know, have been invented, even if they can prohibit the legal manufacture and the legal sale, just the same way that illegal drugs are so available.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we're sort of on the verge of the same thing. To back up slightly, you mentioned that the prohibition of machine guns seems to have worked to some extent. And I wonder if that's simply because there weren't that many in circulation back in the 1930s. And by prohibiting it sort of prospectively, we were able somehow to nip that one in the bud. And then conversely, the bump stock seems to have sneaked past a lot of the regulators. And I understand that they're now selling like hotcakes as enthusiasts go out and try to beat whatever regulations coming down the pike. I wonder if perhaps we're about to lose control of that technology, too.
They should definitely, in principle, they should be regulated the same way as machine guns, if not even more strictly and prohibited completely. They hadn't been that popular. They'd only been available for a couple of years. And in fact, I'd never heard of them. And I've been working on gun policy for quite some time. It's a concern. You know, when we talk about gun control, we're often talking about one of two things. One is bad guns. There, the concern is, well, let's get rid of bad guns and only have good guns. And among the bad guns, in 1968, we thought of so-called Saturday night specials or cheap handguns were the bad gun. And there was Congress passed a law restricting imports or banning imports of cheap handguns. And then assault weapons, another example of bad guns, 50 caliber rifles, another example, and machine guns, another example. So would we be a safer world? Could we ban bad guns and just live with good guns? I think we have to try to do that, but often the line between a bad gun and a good gun is very thin.
Well, James B. Jacobs of New York University, a sociologist, law professor, a person who's been studying this gun control problem, gun rights problem for many, many years. Thank you very much for taking the time to share your wisdom with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. I love talking about this stuff.
And that's our show. Thanks very much to both of our guests today. James B. Jacobs, whom we just heard from New York University, and before him, Saul Cornell of Fordham University. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our production intern is Donald Crenshaw. And our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.